We're talking with David Politis about his latest project, Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants, archived articles 1680 to 1922, packed with some really great stories that I doubt that many of you have read or even heard of before about encounters with different beings that we might equate with Sasquatch. And some of these are kind of funny. You know, people get terrified. They have horrible reactions. They want to shoot at these things, chase after them, or be chased away by them. And then there are other accounts where they describe them as good-natured, and they seem to get along, and we're not threatening at all. And we're going to get into some of those stories, and a little bit later we'll open up the phone lines with your calls and questions and comments for Dave as well. We'll be right back. Dave Politis, you know, looking back at your original book, The Hoopa Project, it's still, all these years later, I don't think there's anything quite like it in the field. And you look at these drawings by Harvey Pratt, these look like human faces. These are individual faces that he's drawn, forensic drawings based on witness descriptions. They look like people, just big hairy people, but people.
No, I think that's the general consensus. That it sort of matches what other tribes have stated all across the U.S. And when you try to find a group of people that have been here hundreds and hundreds of years and occupy the land, to find a group that says they're an animal, I never could find it. And you know, again, I have no dog in the fight. I'm willing to listen to anything, but that just isn't there.
You look back at the Patterson-Gimlin film, and it's, you know, people can argue about it all they want. As far as I'm concerned, it has not been debunked. But that being in that film looks closer to a gorilla or ape, not exactly a match, but it's closer to it than some of the creatures, the beings that you have drawings of in this, and the beings that are described in the new book as well. I mean, you know, they're very close to human-like, just much larger.
So one thing I did with the Gimlin film, and one thing Harvey has the ability at, is let's say somebody goes into a bank, robs the bank, has a beard on, has a hat on, and they're caught on camera leaving. Well, Harvey has this innate ability to take the beard off the face so you can see what the face looks like, so you can identify the suspect. So apply that to the Patterson-Gimlin film. Harvey took the hair off the face of the Patterson-Gimlin biped. It's in Tribal Bigfoot, and it's stunning. It looks like a Native American man.
I guess the argument could be made, and probably has been made, there are different types. There are different tribes, which is why some of the descriptions are so different. I mean, you have, you know, in the history of the phenomena, you have reports of different colors, different sizes. In your accounts, in these clippings from over the last couple of centuries, there are male and clearly distinctions between male and female specimens that are seen, right?
Well, I think people forget how different humans are. In my presentations at conferences, I sometimes will take a variety of photos of Amazon tribal members, of people from northern Ukraine, of people from China, and I put these pictures up there, and it's phenomenal how different humans look. If they are some type of human, as I think they are, then it just follows with what we understand about our own people.
Yeah, if you were a space alien, you came here and went back home and described what humans look like, you know, you might have some trouble. They can't all look like that, you know, from because we vary so differently. In these clips, you have some of them that are pretty short. I don't remember where it is in the book, but there was an incident where somebody's campfire, their camp, kept being messed with while they're out in the woods somewhere. So they waited, lurked in the bushes to wait to see what came and did it. And as I recall, the creatures that came, it was one or two. They were short. They were like five or six feet tall, not 10 or 12 feet tall, but covered with hair, and they were just kind of playing with the fire.
So think about, let's say, a 12-year-old kid who doesn't have much association with fire. Not a grown adult comes into the fire, is playing with it because they have this unique opportunity. That's kind of what I was thinking as I read that article. It's from California, I think from the mid-1800s. And I think it was a hunter that knew something was messing around, but he couldn't figure it out, so he waited on a ridgeline. They came in, and he saw this. And it's not unusual that hunters and campers and other things in the woods have seen these things doing unusual things. Other times they're seen in a lake playing like kids in the water. Again, the behavior that you read about reminds you sometimes of children, and especially when the sizes match proportionally a smaller Bigfoot, you think, well, it must be a young kid.
The attitudes are different in different reports, too. Generally not hostile, shy, want to get away from people when they encounter him, but they can be pretty nasty when provoked. There's a phenomenon that's reported in several of these clips where they throw rocks, big rocks, at humans to sort of chase them off. And there's one report, I think it's, I forget where it is in the book, I'll have to look for it, of a Bigfoot that supposedly killed a hunter, right? That was the first one you found?
Well, it was, and you know, sometimes I question the credibility of some of these articles because who saw it? How did they get to those conclusions? Was there any evidence left behind? These older articles are sometimes tough to get to the root of where they came from or how they came to those conclusions. And I don't put a lot of emphasis on that. But in the near term, I've never found a Bigfoot nowadays that's conclusively killed anybody. And when I started writing the Missing 411 books, there's a lot of erroneous information that I have associated this topic on Bigfoot with Missing 411. I never have. I've never stated that I thought that Bigfoot was involved in these things. Why? Because I've never read a credible article implying that they did. And since the 411 books came out, all of a sudden, people have started saying, oh yeah, you know, this campsite, these campers were killed, this was happening. And I get these once a year, say. And every time I follow it up, I find that it's not a credible source, it never happened, yet the myths keep perpetuating on the internet, and they're not true. And some people believe, oh, you know, it's a cover-up. But as someone who has spent an enormous amount of time in these rural areas with these rural sheriffs and deputies, those people do not give a damn about what the federal government thinks about their behavior, and trying to convince them to keep their mouth shut, that's never going to happen. They will tell the truth, and the feds aren't going to be able to keep them clamped up. So when you hear these stories, oh, you know, these campers were killed by something really mysterious, if it was happening, I'd hear about it from these guys. And they say, half the time they say, it never happened. It's a completely phony story. So,
I get the emails. I can imagine what your emails are like, but I get them just because people know that we know each other. Why doesn't Dave Politis go ahead and admit it's Bigfoot that's kidnapping people? And I would have to say this, Dave, there are some accounts in this book, these newspaper clippings, where there are references to these huge wild men carrying off women and children. You know, there are never any names attached to it, though. You know, no.
And that's the tough part of it. How can you leverage it as credible if supposedly they were getting carried off? Who saw it? And why aren't the names there? And if somebody's writing about it, then say it.
Seems to be there are instances where in these accounts where the humans who are not aggressive and don't take shots at these animals, not only do they describe them as, I think it's gay. They describe them as gay, and I don't think it's in the context of gay as we use the term these days, but gay humor is what they said, like friendly.
And the number of times I have heard a hunter say, there's no way I could shoot it, it looked too human. I have never heard of a hunter say, oh yeah, I had to kill this thing, I shot it in the head, or it looked like an animal. I have not heard that. And I've heard the human side of it from a fireman, policeman, credible sources that continually say the same thing. And it isn't just one time in history. It goes way back in history. So there's something to this that got got askew, where they said they started looking like apes and animals. And as you know, George, there's a segment of the Bigfoot world that wants to go out and kill one. And yeah. I don't have any idea why they think they need to kill one. Maybe it's some kind of overload on testosterone, but they should wake up to the reality they're never going to kill one. It's not going to happen.
There are some reports of where these people claim to have killed one, or they've captured a wild man, and they've brought him back somewhere on a ship, or they've got him in jail, and invariably he gets away, or the evidence disappears, however.
Yeah, and probably the one case, and you know about it, the Minnesota wild man. That has a lot of intrigue to it, because I've seen pictures of it, and I've seen descriptions of it, and it is unusual, and nobody quite knows what happens to it, but a lot of people just poo-poo it and say, oh, you know, that was a fake meant for the circus. But the more you dig into that one, there was something strange with that.
Well, I find myself rooting for the wild man or whatever it is to get away in all these cases, so I'm glad it ends up that way. You know, you look at where these reports come from. They're from major newspapers, too. I mean, the Boston Globe and the San Francisco newspaper, the L.A. Times, and it's some great writing. Some of these descriptions is just terrific writing. It's somebody wasn't just phoning it in when they were working on this story. And the fact that they come from places like Indiana and Iowa and Kansas, that's not where we associate Bigfoot sightings, modern sightings at all. I was trying to think of why would Ohio and Pennsylvania be so prominent in the numbers? And it's because, I mean, that was a center of American civilization in the 1700s or so, 1780s, where the bigger cities were. It wasn't exactly the frontier because there were people out here as well, but that's where the bulk of the population probably lived at the time.
Oh, exactly. And it's an interesting phenomenon when you start to look at the sighting locations in conjunction to the giant sightings and skeletons. And then if you go back in history and you think about exactly what you said, where did we first establish civilization and cities? And as we moved west, where were these locations? But then even the weirder thing to me is Ohio has a lot of these sightings. Well, that's Bruce McAbee lives in Ohio. He's a friend, and I went to spend 4 or 5 days with him earlier this year. And the strange things that he's told me that have happened in Ohio, in the air and on the ground, it's really strange.
Bruce McAbee is welcome here anytime. He's a fascinating guy, both in person and on the air and in his books. You know, it was kind of surprising to see the early reports from Hungary. I'd never heard of Hungarian Bigfoot or Sasquatch reports until reading this book of yours.
Well, I'd never heard of them either. And again, a surprising fact that they're writing about it from there. And then in the Pyrenees, there's an article from there about a sighting. And when you look at the descriptions that they're offering, it's almost identical to what they're seeing here in the U.S. at the same time period or thereabouts. And then when you think about present-day sightings, again, from almost every continent in the world, which is unusual.
You know, some of the descriptions, obviously, you have to take them in a cultural context. Now, I don't remember when the Jungle Book was written, but Mowgli, the character Mowgli, you know, he's described, that description is used in a couple of the newspaper clippings from that era that you've collected here.
Correct. And people always tell me, well, what about the Star Wars creature that looks like Bigfoot? I said, yeah, that's kind of strange.
That it was inspired by, maybe? Yeah, I don't know. It's a similarity. Some of the descriptions, I would have to leap through it here to find one, but it seems like the witnesses are saying that the wild men have clothes or items of clothing or just a loinskin kind of a thing, which suggests to me maybe they were humans. Maybe they really were literally wild men out there.
Well, unusually and occasionally, even nowadays, you hear about Bigfoot wearing clothing. And it kind of goes unexplainable, because why would they do that? But, you know, maybe it's some association. Maybe they're trying to break a barrier if they're seen. Maybe they think they'll be accepted more if they're seen. Maybe people won't be so scared. You know, we could all throw in our conjecture about why that may be happening, but it happens too often for people to be fabricating it. I hear it occasionally, but not very often.
If you were to communicate with a tribe these days, a modern tribe that would still perhaps be in contact, other than the Hoopas, are there any other tribes that you would say people that have a relationship ongoing with whatever these things are?
I would say it's almost everyone. I mean, there's famous stories out of Arizona and New Mexico and the High Plains out there where they have these, and there's many times an association between, and this is where Bigfoot people start, their heads start spinning, but fact, where there's this association between Bigfoot and UFOs. Even in the Hoopa book, I wrote that many of the tribal people said that they saw a UFO in close time and space to the point where they saw Bigfoot. And they regularly saw UFOs on many of the tribal grounds. And when you talk to these tribal members, the elders, they believe they came from the stars. And they're not, once they have your trust, they will tell you, hey, you know, there's this association between us and them, and they're a different kind of tribe and a different kind of people, but they came from the same place we did. And when you start to go back and you look at the history of these certain areas, there's a lot of tribal people that will tell you, we've had visitations for hundreds and hundreds of years going back in time, and almost all of them believe that they came from the stars.
Well, there are an awful lot of associations between these creatures being sighted in proximity to UFOs, and it makes everyone uncomfortable. The Bigfoot people, the diehards, don't like it. The UFO diehards like it even less. They're not comfortable with that at all. But you have to follow it where it leads. And, you know, I don't have a conviction on it either. I don't know what these things are. I don't know what UFOs are or where they're from. But there's enough cases over the centuries, and a lot more of them now, thanks to this new book, that you can't ignore it. I thought the interest, there was a couple of stories, clippings, where there are reputable witnesses who say they saw these creatures engaging with cows, milking cows.
So this is the part that really, really is unusual. Several years ago, one of my best friends, their parents own a dairy farm. And I started talking to him about this. And I said, you know, I keep reading that they may be milking cows. You know, what do you think about that? And he goes, you know, let me go talk to my parents. So they own a huge dairy farm. And he went out there and talked to him. And this I think he's 80 years old, this guy's dad. And he looked at him and he said, you know, every once in a while, my cow will come back from nowhere completely milked. He goes, I don't understand it. And then the same man told him, he says, you know, every once in a while I'm on the far corner of my property and something tells me, don't turn around. Get back on the horse or get back on my ATV and leave. And he does. And then the man said, well, you know, every once in a while I found a bucket way out in the corner of the property. I don't know how it got there.
So what about dogs?
I think when you get the trust of some of these dairy farmers way out in the middle, they're going to tell you the same thing, because I've heard it many times.
You know, there are some funny stories. They're not in this book, but I've recalled, I think you and I have talked about it before, about Bigfoot, what they eat. And they'll, you know, they're kind of particular. This image of a Bigfoot milking a cow sticks in my head. But, I mean, they've been known to eat a lot of berries and different kinds of fruit. Do they eat meat? As far as you know?
Well, according to the tribal people who have seen them take deer, et cetera, they're an omnivore. And many times when the natives are in the middle of the woods hunting themselves, they'll come across a deer that's stuck up in a tree. And like a 250-pound deer, a native guy couldn't have done it. And they don't know how it got way up in the tree. And it's not in a tornado or a hurricane zone. So how did it get there?
Dave Politis, Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants is the book. In a moment, we'll open up the phone lines with your calls and questions and comments. White flag into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Dave Politis about Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants, archived articles 1680 to 1922, his new book. And as I told you, some of these descriptions of the writing is just terrific on the part of reporters from long ago. This is from the State Ledger in Mississippi, July 4th, 1884. The title, Wild Wizard of the Woods, in which the reporter describes an encounter. On one occasion, he, the creature, was seen devouring a large fish with demoniacal greed. In a short space of time between his massive jaws and enormous teeth, the bones being crushed as if they were straws. This guy came to work that day and did his job. We're going to go to the phones in a moment. Looks like they're pretty full. Dave Politis still working his magic with the Coast to Coast audience. We'll be right back. Right, here we go. Calls for my guest, Dave Politis. First-time caller, Gwen in Pittsburgh. Hi, Gwen.
Oh, hey there. Thank you for letting me on your show, first of all.
Welcome.
Second of all, David, I have had many sleepless nights listening to everything about the missing persons. Like, it is one of the most unsettling things that I've heard in a long time. So, good job on your findings. I wanted to talk about the Bigfoot thing. I actually think I really love how you're saying it, how it's related to wild men. I feel like drones are also a good way that we could find out more about wild men, because there are Amazonian tribes that were just discovered, like, for the first time with drones. And I feel like your idea is revolutionary, and I feel like within the next 10 years, we'll definitely have an answer because of drones. And my question to you is, do you feel like you're going to use drones in your research at all?
So, drones are an interesting topic, but there was actually some PhD-level people that thought that drones were going to be good for finding Bigfoot, and that was a complete bomb. So, drones are never going to work for a Bigfoot topic. The missing people topic, they have used drones before on missing people. It hasn't worked real well, and you can't use a drone in a national park. It's against the law, and there's a huge fine, so probably won't happen. Now, George, before we go on to the next call, I had a question for you, and maybe you can kind of touch on it for the people here. Your work on Skinwalker Ranch, the researchers there saw something very similar to a Bigfoot. Can you tell us about that?
Actually, multiple times. It's more the tribe that encounters them. They've seen them there as long as they've lived there. There was a very dramatic instance. I've got transcripts of the interviews with the officers. And we went to the spot where it happened, but the dogs, there were police officers patrolling tribal grounds. They have a gift shop that's just off the highway there on the Ute Reservation. And the dogs alerted the officers to this huge thing that was just outside the window. And as soon as the dogs made a noise and this thing looked at the officers and shone a light on it, it took off running. And it went all the way through the community. And you could hear it. It was just taking these giant strides. It knocked over garbage cans. You had alarms going off, and the police officers chased it. I think they found some tracks. It led to there's a reservoir there that's just on the other side of Skinwalker Ranch, and that's where they lost it. It just kind of sort of disappeared. They've seen similar creatures on the ranch itself. I shouldn't call it Bigfoot. It's more like humanoids. And there's one particular instance that we've described on the program before where these two scientists and two other people who were observers up on Skinwalker Ridge had seen what looked like a dirty snowball of light that was floating just off the ground in the middle homestead there on the ranch. And through infrared, you can see the ball of light started stretching into what looked like a tunnel. And through this tunnel, this creature started crawling. They could see it. These guys were really excited seeing this thing. It's coming from somewhere else in this tunnel of light, wriggling through, struggling to get through this skinny little opening. It pulls itself out at the entrance to this tunnel, stands up. It's 8 feet tall, featureless, dark, humanoid-shaped, like a head with no neck on a body. It just stands up and then starts moving up towards Skinwalker Ridge where these guys are watching it, and they can tell you they got the hell out of there. They were pretty scared about the whole thing, but there have been multiple sightings of that by humans, by scientists, by dogs. The tribe has the best handle on it and has seen it all over the Uinta Basin. So, yeah, it's pretty common in that area. And of course, it's in proximity to a lot of other really strange stuff. So you have to ask the question about what is the association between these creatures that are described in many different ways and a lot of other very unusual phenomena. And we don't know. West of the Rockies, Kyle in Utah. Hi, Kyle. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
All right. What's on your mind?
So I had, you were talking about, David was talking about Joseph Fielding Smith, the one who talked to Cain on his saddle. He saw a Bigfoot. It happened in 1835. He was on his way to another town to go proselyte. And he was an apostle at the time, not the prophet. And he ran into Cain, and he described Cain as a tall figure that was taller than a saddle. And Joseph Fielding Smith talked to Cain, and Cain introduced himself. He said, "I'm a man. I'm cursed, and I wander here and there, and my goal." Well, basically, he wanted to make men misery, to destroy their souls. So as you brought that up, I just thought, in Mormon culture, LDS culture that we have, you know, there's two stories that are really famous. That story, then Joseph Fielding Smith, who is Joseph Smith's nephew. You know, his brother had an encounter, Wesley Smith, in Hawaii at the dedication at the Lei Hawaii Temple in 1921. Cain came through the doors of the temple, and in his hand, Wesley Smith said that that was the priesthood to cast Cain out, and so he rose his hand in the name of Jesus Christ to cast you out, and Cain ran. And so it's interesting you say that, because in our church, you know, like, some people are really skeptical, like they're kind of hush hush, like, let's not talk about it. But as people continue to go on, you know, they're starting to more accept it. But I was just wondering for David, like, with these disappearances, because I've been reading this book for a little while and stuff. Like, do you think it's a Bigfoot? Do you think it's, like, does he have any idea what's going on? Because, like, people are asking me, you know, and, like, people know me to kind of have an interest in a little bit of this stuff.
Well, let me tell you, Kyle, that everyone listening here tonight is probably the weirdo expert in their family and in their social circle. You and everyone listening is likely the go-to person in their own circles for information about these kind of topics. Dave, to begin with, the Joseph Smith story, is that likely a Bigfoot-type encounter, or is that something else?
Well, the description that Smith gave would match a Bigfoot. But then there's people who are researching this topic who believe that the Bigfoot may be some type of Nephilim from the Bible. And when you read that, there is some association there that makes some sense. Now, Scott Carpenter, another researcher in the Bigfoot world, has written a book about this. It's compelling, and there's some strong evidence that he's come across that may join the two topics. In other things, like in the Smith incident, the part that's unusual is that it came and it spoke to him. And he never said it mind spoke, but more like it spoke to him. So hard to say. I don't know. But one thing, like this gentleman asked about my thoughts and things, I've always stated that I'm a man of facts. All of my books are filled with facts. There aren't any opinions about what's going on. I allow you to come to your own opinion. And why do I do that? Because there are no facts to establish any current pattern that points to one suspect. When you look at the Bigfoot world, there's nothing that points to an exact equation of what we're dealing with other than the DNA. But again, if you stick with the facts and allow the public to come to their own thoughts, I have never met anybody who's read my 8 books, and there have been thousands, that has come to me and said, "I know exactly what's happening." Doesn't happen.
And I should point out that, you know, you did address this. Maybe Kyle didn't hear it, but there are no credible stories, in your view, of Bigfoot being responsible for carting people off, as far as you know.
Well, no, killing them. I think
killing them. Okay.
There's a story that John Green wrote about a prospector that was taken in British Columbia, where he took an affidavit from this man, and he was sleeping in his sleeping bag, and one of these bipeds grabbed his bag and started walking with him for hours and ended up dumping him in a cave. And he was eventually escaped, but he said he saw this family of Bigfoot in the cave, and they kind of watched him, and he kind of watched them. It's a really, really good story. And the individual at the time signed an affidavit. I followed Green's lead and said, this is a good way to document the stories I hear, and that's kind of how it came to pass.
I remember that story now. Yeah, that is a good one. Isn't there some other account in one of your books about a witness claiming to see a Bigfoot-type creature carrying a person through the forest? Doesn't ring a bell?
Yeah.
I'll have to think about it.
So there's a story out of Wyoming that I don't put much credence in it because the people didn't come forward and they were doing something illegal. But a girl disappeared in Wyoming, and two people who were poaching were out in the woods, and they claimed that they saw a Bigfoot carrying this body under its arm. It appeared dead. So these people never came forward. I don't know who they are. The story was given to me but from another Bigfoot researcher that's well known, and this guy was called supposedly by these two guys, and then he told me. So it's third hand down the line. I would say might be true, might not, but there's no evidence that it is.
All right, east of the Rockies, Bob in Indiana. Good morning, Bob. You're on with Dave Politis.
Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Knapp, I've got two questions. Mr. Politis, are your books on audio?
No, sir.
Okay, when you lost most of your eyesight, it's a neat... It's a neat thing. Anyway,
that's a good idea, Bob. You should put those books on audio. Dave, you should do that sometime.
Yeah, if I could get you to narrate them, George, that'd be great.
Okay. We'll cut a deal. Bob, what's your other question?
They live in the forest. I wonder if they bury their dead since nobody's ever found a body, and you would think that one or more would have been struck by lightning.
So, good point. And when you talk to the Native Americans, some of them say that Bigfoot does bury their bodies. And when they bury them, they put giant, giant boulders on top so that they'll never be disturbed. Another story I've heard is that they'll bury them in a river under giant rocks. And they'll carry the body out into the middle of the river. They'll put it under giant, giant boulders in the river, and it'll dissipate and never be found. The idea is that the body's never touched. So it could be true. I don't know.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate
it. Thank you. Uh-huh.
We're going to Eric in Illinois on the wild card line. Good morning, Eric.
George, this is Eric, the mind control guy. How's everybody doing tonight?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Anyway, I got a couple things here. A lot of folks, they kind of, you know, what I refer to as these swaggering, arrogant skeptics that make an effort not to believe in anything. And they always want to say, how come, you know, there's not more Bigfoot seen? Well, for one thing, Bigfoot is just like any other resident of the wilderness. They're always on the move. They're nomads. They're always looking for their next meal, just like deer, raccoons, possums, anything. They're always on the move. And the other thing is, when a lot of folks who are a witness to Bigfoot, they always say there's this real putrid smell, and folks wonder why. Well, I tell you what, if you lived your whole life and you never took a bath or washed your teeth, you're going to smell funky. And I would say, you know, one thing Bigfoot needs to be introduced to is body wash, shampoo, and toothpaste. And then it might not be so funky. But I just wanted to throw that out there.
All right. Dave, thoughts on Bigfoot being nomadic? From the witness reports, do families stay in the same area or do they move around?
Well, you kind of touched on something that I bring up at conferences, and it's really food for thought. First of all, I'm with you, George. I think the Patterson-Gimlin film has never been debunked. Disney Studios came out and said that they, at that time, they could have never made a costume that was as good as what was in that segment. So it's a minute-and-a-half segment in 1967. I want everyone to think about what was the percentage of people in the wilderness in 1967 that had the ability to take film of anything while they were in the wilderness. It was minute. Now think about today. Nobody has ever come close to take in video or film of a Bigfoot in the wilderness for a minute and a half like they got on that PG film. Yet today, there's probably close to 100% of everybody in the wilderness carrying a smartphone, which has the ability to catch that. So I want everyone to understand that I do believe the Patterson film is real, but why haven't we caught this biped on film in that quality of a location and segment like they did in 67? There was something phenomenal about that event that caused that female Bigfoot to stay there, because every other time they immediately run. They won't look at the camera like this one did. They won't hang around and linger knowing that people are watching them. Something unusual happened.
Well, again, not to take everything back to Skinwalker Day, but the comparison is pretty clear, is that that phenomena there was elusive. There were cameras all over the place. If you had activity in one area and set a camera up, it would move somewhere else. And it goes back to sort of the question that one of the callers asked about drones. Say you had a drone that had heat-seeking technology attached to it. The description from the tribes that you mentioned in your books suggests this thing has camouflage abilities, that it can cloak itself, that it changes shapes, and it can hide.
Correct. That's, again, one of the reasons that makes this entire topic difficult to research.
Yeah, I mean, we see it when it wants to be seen, I guess.
Yeah.
Try to get one more call in. Tom in Vancouver, up there in Bigfoot country. Hey, Tom, how you doing? Is Tom on the wildcard line? Hello? I think Tom is gone. Okay, so we're about out of time, Dave. Great work. The title being 1680 to 1922, does that suggest that another book of archived articles about these sightings could come some other time?
Well, not really, no. And just so everyone knows, this is a book that contains the actual articles. These aren't rewrites of the articles. This is the real deal. 1922 was a cutoff point for copyrights on those articles.
Oh,
so before then, you could print them. After them, you can't because they're still protected.
Well, it's a terrific piece of work. I loved reading it. I want to go back and read it again because there's so many details that escaped me as I was preparing for the program. But as I said, some of the writing in this is just terrific, and it's always great to have you on the program. And I don't know when you sleep, but I hope you're taking care of yourself.
Hey, I'm always eager to be on your show, George, and the response I get from being on your show is out of this world good. So I appreciate the effort you put into it.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate it. And maybe we'll have you and get Melba Ketchum back on here sometime and talk about that DNA stuff.
That'd be great.
All right. Dave Politis, again, The Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants is the new book. Check it out if you get a chance. In a moment, we shift gears to talk about the true story of the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history and the 50-year fight to exonerate an innocent man. Indianapolis coming up momentarily. We'll be right back.